Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, and welcome to Jazz Talk, a Jazz on the Tube podcast. My name is Ken McCarthy, and this is where we talk with people who are doing important work that supports and illuminates the music we love. The writers, the scholars, the educators, the filmmakers, the producers, and more.
My name's Ken McCarthy, and I have a website called Jazz on the Tube, and I've been interested in jazz a long time, and I've been interested in jazz education a very long time. I actually wrote my undergraduate thesis on how do people learn jazz, and I wrote it so long ago I forgot that I wrote it, and I was just reminded of that today. And so when I discovered Vic's work, I was really interested. And my big question is, people have other questions to address too, is how can we use the things that Vic's uncovered to help more people become capable and happy musicians? Because I personally found music education to be torture when I was a kid, and I'm wondering if there's a better way. So that's sort of my motivation for getting us all together.
So maybe I'll throw in something, and I'm sure Vic has plenty to say too. This is David Wright. One of the things that we noticed with those jazz greats like Armstrong was that he learned things by ear. He was a musician before he even ever learned to read music. And I can identify with that because I learned vocal harmony, you know, as a kid, and I could harmonize with things, and my family could harmonize with things. And much, much later, I learned the names for chords, major chord, minor chord, you know, dominant, you know, circle of fifths, all this stuff. And I'd been understanding this stuff for years, but just in my ear, not knowing what the proper terminology was. And that seems to be the same with a lot of the people who played jazz in the early days, and maybe people who pick it up now. They're ear singers or ear players, and then they learn the music that just confirms what they already had discovered themselves. And maybe it's the principle of this thing is self-discovery is the best kind of education.
Yeah, I mean, don't we learn to speak and understand language long before we start to write it?
Absolutely.
Or read it?
Yeah. It's the same kind of thing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give my own experience. Go ahead, please, Monica.
Yeah, I mean, the thought that came to mind is it's also an age thing. You know, you said about learning the singing at an early age, and there's a time where you learn by imitating much easier, but it's pretty much over by 12 years old. I mean, it doesn't mean you can't learn it still, but that time where it just kind of filters in automatically and you're going, yeah, I'll just take it in like a sponge, that is early. So in addition to thinking about how to do it, I would also put in the point here when to do it.
Excellent, yeah. And
that they speak about, you know, elementary education, elementary music education.
Exactly.
You know, In Lynn Abbott's article about barbershop harmony, it talks about these harmonizers, probably, African-American, staying around the field and just discovering harmony. You know, they were probably young men, and they were just out there finding new chords, finding new harmonies to sing. And, of course, when Armstrong sang with his quartet, he had to have been younger than 12 or 13 because that's the year that he shot the gun in the air and got taken off to the reform school. So he was a very young man when he was singing vocal harmony on the streets of New Orleans.
And in his estimate, thanks to Vic for pointing this out, in his estimate, he had the best boy singing group in all of New Orleans. So he'd been doing it for a while.
Right.
Up by 12.
Right. Yep. Yeah.
You sure had. I mean, I think the thing for me about this thing, I mean, although I've sort of run jazz workshops for 20 years or so, I don't do it at the moment, but I have done it. I don't really think of myself as primarily a jazz educator, more just a researcher. But the thing that it seems to me is that, you know, we have developed a very theoretical approach to how we approach jazz, with sort of chord analysis, chord scales. And I suppose in a way, the barbershop practice actually turns what we do as jazz educators completely on its head. Rather than trying to sort of improvise a melody over a set of a pre-existent chord pattern, what barbershop practice tends to do is start with a melody and then find a sort of second voice, a counter melody, whatever you want to call it, to find a harmony, develop a harmony with the different voices. So I think really getting back to tunes and melody for me is perhaps one of the ways that we can start to conceptualize this as something that we could use in jazz education.
Well, it's instructive that Louis Armstrong never took a jazz course, certainly didn't, because it didn't exist. He created music off of a foundation, and you're right. Yeah, it was a sort of a very fundamental, melody-driven, experiential-driven playing, fooling around. You know, playing in the best sense of the word. And so, how do we get that into music education?
But you know, I wouldn't even call it jazz education. And thinking about how can we prepare jazz players for it, I think it's just a overall major, how can we have a better musical relationship to, or a better relationship to music from early on? And I, you know, I keep going back, but I'm such a firm believer we have to drill right into early childhood and elementary education and just make singing, music making part of the daily curriculum. And then you have that foundation to draw from everybody. And unfortunately, that's, you know, it's been getting sparse over the last year. And then music is often separated from what you do in the rest. But, you know, how easily would it be to just incorporate learning tunes and a basic folk repertoire and using melodies, well, there's Bob Dorrell with his Schoolhouse Rock, right?
Mm-hmm.
to learn principles and incorporate that from early on. I think that's just such a key thing, to just think, how can we have this better relationship to expressing ourselves with music and using that language of music without thinking it's a foreign language.
You know, what? One of the things that I personally have in common with Louis Armstrong is that we both learned solfège as a kid. And Armstrong mm-hmm. talks about just knowing the scale tones, you know, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti. And whenever he sang a melody or sang a harmony part or played a melody or harmony part on his horn, he was always thinking what scale tone he was on. And, you know, that's a pretty neat concept, because it takes people away from keys. You know, people look at keys and they get all confused. You know, what's the key of E-flat? How do I finger that on my clarinet or something? But, you know, if you're thinking scale tones, of course, playing an instrument, you still have to learn the fingerings, but you know where you're going. You know how it sounds. And I used to sit in church. I grew up in kind of fundamentalist church, and we use shape notes. And there's two systems of shape notes. One is sung by the Sacred Harp singers, and they have, like, I believe, five shapes. But the old Southern gospel had seven shapes, one for do, one for re, you know, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti. And I looked at those, and, you know, I knew how to sing any note of the scale, and I started noticing harmony. You know, when I was an eight-year-old kid, the tonic chord was a housetop, a diamond, and a circle, because that was do, mi, and sol. And so I, you know, one thing that might be great, you know, one thing that you said, Monica, is yes, let's go back to learning melodies and maybe learning how to harmonize melodies mm-hmm. just by ear, but also just learning basic scale tones, you know, and where in the scale are we? Because most of our music is very key oriented, you know, it's got do. And you know, with Armstrong, all you need to know is tell me where do is, now tell me what key we're in, and I can start playing or improvising.
Good point.
Dude, when you say shape notes, were the notes literally different shapes each?
Yes. Instead of a round note, if it was do, like if you were in the key of F, every F was shaped like a little housetop, you know. every scale tone too, so the key of F, is, if it was G, it was shaped like a little, I don't know, round bottom, flat at the top, like a cereal bowl or something. So each scale tone has its own shape. And, you know, I got to where I didn't even care about the key or the lines and spaces. All I looked at was the shapes because that told me what scale tone I was on.
Wow.
And I think a lot of musicians think that way. They may not think actual shapes, but that's not the point. The point is scale tone, where you are relative to the tonal center of the keynote. That's what's important to a good harmonizer. And even today, you know, when barbershop harmonizers get together, you know, quite frequently we teach each other little harmonies very quickly. You know, we call them tags. You know, it's just a little piece of harmony that lasts about 15 seconds or 20 seconds. And you just say to the other guy, okay, you start on 5, you start on 3, you start on 7, and, you know, and take off. And so everybody's very key-oriented. They know where they are relative to the key. It doesn't matter what key you're in. You can blow an F, you can blow a G. As long as it's in range, it doesn't matter.
Would it be accurate to say they're interval-oriented?
Interval-oriented,
yeah, I mean, because I say I made this revelation very late in life, like a couple of months ago, that the notes are not what creates the sound. It's the intervals that create the melody, the relationship between the notes.
That's right. That's right. So the melody goes do, re, mi, sol, or something like that. It's those intervals that characterize that melody in your head and make you able to recognize it.
And that's where I think maybe there's a mistake in, you know, handing a kid an instrument and then handing him a book and saying, you know, push these buttons to make a song come out, you know,
right.
Because you're note focused as opposed to relationship between note focused, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And you kind of play dead, you know, like if you've ever heard certain children's orchestras, I don't mean to take away anybody's, you know, accomplishment, but sometimes you hear some of these kids orchestras and it's not that they're out of tune. That's not the problem. It's that they sound dead. Like they're not playing a tune. They're just sort of walking through a set of instructions, which is
memorized notes.
Yeah, which is totally different than the musical impulse.
Yeah.
One of the things, Ken, about the sort of music education in New Orleans was that it was absolutely the norm that you learned to sing before you learned to play. Bunk Johnson, for example, talks about how he, I think, spent 5 years singing before anybody put an instrument in his hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was seen as a necessary prerequisite. And, of course, I mean, that's what we do in classical music as well. You know, if somebody wants to be a classical musician, we start them off on Bach chorales and singing in choirs and learning these intervals and sight reading, you know. So maybe this is one of the important things that we could consider getting back to a more sort of vocally orientated approach to music.
And also learning basic harmonies before you even attempt to play more complicated ones. You know,
mm-hmm.
if people, you know, of course, jazz, for example, has evolved a lot since New Orleans jazz. There's very abstruse jazz. And yet if a person just goes in to learn that directly, bypassing the step of learning the more basic kind of jazz that has, you know, pretty straightforward harmonies and melodies, I think they're missing something. It's important that you understand the basic thing first and get that in your bones And then that allows you a point of departure to try to really understand or reproduce something like what Miles Davis or Charlie Parker did.
Going back to the solfège, is that what you call it?
Solfège.
And I'd actually, I heard of it for the first time from a guy named Lionel Fairbose, who's a New Orleans trumpeter. And like you said, Vic, he said he wasn't allowed to touch an instrument until he had 2 years, in his case, of solfège under his belt. And then I checked this with some of the older musicians in Cuba, a fellow I know who's 90, and same thing for him. They had to do solfège first. He hated it, though, by the way. I asked him about it. He hated it, so maybe it was the way it was taught to him. I don't know.
But it goes back, you know, just to clarify, it goes back to the Kodály method. So that was the Hungarian composer who sort of devised a system of even hand signals that go scale degree. And so a lot of this is based on that. So just in case somebody wants to look back and see exactly how it was taught.
When did it disappear?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was just curious. You know, David, you were saying that you learned this when you were young. But at what point did this sort of stop being taught in the American education system? I wouldn't be able to answer that for the British one either. But I'm just kind of curious.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer, but I would venture to say a long time ago. You know, Armstrong said he learned it in school. I know that my dad, who went to a one-room school in Kentucky, in rural Kentucky, learned it. That's the way they taught music back then. And, of course, everybody had it in their hymn book, so, you know, I don't know if they used the hymn book as an example, but it wasn't just hymns that were written that way, but all the music in their music book was written in shape notes, and they learned solfège. So that would have been, you know, early 20th century, maybe 1920s, but I was never taught solfège or anything like it, you know, when I was sitting in music school.
I mean, I've seen it in sheet music from the 1920s where they've got the do, re, mi's written over the top of the notes, you know.
So okay.
It was still, I guess, common up until then, but I don't know when it went disappeared.
Yeah.
It has not disappeared. I mean, just to clarify, it's not disappeared. There's a lot. There's even the American Kodály Society, and there are elementary teachers who teach it. I know in our elementary education, we at least show it to them. I think it just has been displaced a lot by, you know, there's these method books, the Macmillans, and that usually the elementary teachers use, and they make it much easier. And so it's been displaced a bit, but there are still ones that teach it.
Two questions about that. Is there any association of teachers who can continue to use this method? Like, you know, a group?
The American Kodály Society that definitely is all trained in that, yeah.
And is that a national movement, an international movement?
International, but there's a specific American one.
Is it kind of a vibrant group? Is it growing, holding steady, declining?
I would say at least holding steady. I'm trying to find some info here.
Okay.
To get some numbers for you, it's pretty steady.
How do you spell Kodály?
K-O-D-A. It has like an apostrophe looking to the right, L-Y. And his first name was Zoltán, Z-O-L-T-A-N. He was a Hungarian composer.
So what era did he live in? Do you happen to know?
Well, he passed away. His method was implemented, or he started by 1925. So that's why, you know, you see in all these early education, this is when it got popular and when the settlers took it over to use it as a teaching method. And so by now there's still there's the International Society for Music Education. They have a Kodai group, and then there's the American Kodai Society. But, you know, a lot of teachers who might not go through training off it, they'll just won't teach it that way and use the method books.
So he codified solfège. He didn't invent it.
He came up with the symbols and the syllables to do it, and the system of the multiple solfège.
Because he was born in I'm looking at the web. He was born in 1882, so there must have been something. Nothing like that preceded it, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I think you'll find it actually goes back to 11th century Italy originally.
Yeah, the Italians, their thing is that they didn't have the movable do. So I think when they meant do, it meant C.
Oh, okay.
And re meant D. You know, but it's a short step from there to just, you know, adopt the scale tones. You play the scale in the key of D, it's the same melody as if you play it in the key of C. But I would suspect that the movable do and thinking of music in terms of scale tones probably precedes the late 1800s. My guess is that was probably in American music earlier, in American teaching of music in schools. But I can't prove that, and it may well be that it happened in other countries too.
And you say Monica, you say that something has supplanted it, method books.
Well, you know, commonly elementary music teachers, there's these series that the big publishers put out, like, for example, Macmillan, that have, you know, all your lesson plans and all your songs and all the materials and the recordings. And you can just pretty much take it and use a recording and have the kids sing along, so you don't have to, you know, teach it and come up with everything yourself. And I don't think all of them use the, I mean, they start a little bit with the syllabus, but I don't think they use it eventually, because, you know, elementary music teachers, there are many that are not necessarily musicians. They just happen and end up in the position of having to teach music.
Mm-hmm. So the Kodai teachers are all teaching more or less classic solfège.
So they base it on those hand signs, and, you know, there's even when you teach singing or when you teach choirs, you lead them by showing the notes with the hand signs.
Interesting.
It would be a very positive thing if a little more orientation in that direction could be adopted, you know, in American primary schools. I'm not a school teacher myself, so I'm a little bit ignorant. I don't know what's going on down there. But just a little bit more orientation towards teaching kids simple melodies, teaching them a simple harmony, teaching them solfège and having them understand what the melody notes are in terms of the scale and what the harmony notes are in terms of the scale. That's the thing that launches a child's mind towards being able to hear harmony, and then it's a short step from there to being able to improvise harmony. And really, I think that's the key. If you can get a music student to where he can improvise something, not just read it off the page, you know, not just memorize the notes, but actually improvise something, that's the first step to really understanding music and really being able to do music.
And I imagine this thrived because it was fun. You know,
yeah.
Right? All these guys were trying, you know, getting together and trying to figure out chords because it was, and you mentioned right at the beginning, David, the idea of discovery. You know, it's not just, okay, here's what you must do, you know, but here's elements, here's colors that you can play with and come up with your own creation. Like, for instance, we hand kids a piece of paper and paint, and we expect them to paint a painting, but we very rarely tell kids, write your own arrangement or put a harmony to this or write your own tune.
Right.
And that seems to be, to me, a big gap.
I agree. And again, I'm not speaking from a vast experience because I haven't looked to see what what's happening in the third grade lately. But I suspect there's not a lot of teaching them to harmonize.
The other thing that caught my attention about this is, you often come across schools that are trying to raise money for instruments. And, it's very important that the children have access to instruments. But they could be singing while they're waiting. They could be learning a lot about music before they ever have the instruments in their hand. And then, as we mentioned earlier, that was the way. You didn't get an instrument before you mastered the ability to sight sing. So I imagine kids aren't even being taught to sight sing unless they're in one of these kodai classrooms.
They may be being taught the sight sing, but they're probably not being taught to think of it in terms of scale tones. I do think sight singing gets taught, but it might be in terms of intervals. I don't know. I don't think it's very scale tone oriented. I could be wrong about that, but that's my impression.
Well, my experience of learning music was we did have, from time to time, we did have a choir teacher come in, and she'd teach us the song, and it had to be by ear because we weren't reading anything, and it was all unison. There was no harmony, and we just sang the songs together. It was fun. And then my other experience of music was, okay, here's a piano. Here's instructions. Put this finger there, put that finger there, and I kind of ignored it. I just memorized the tune and then played it back, which I imagine a lot of kids do, because it does seem illogical to start reading and even dealing with an instrument until you can sing all the melodies that you have in your mind.
That's true, and the jazz guys did. They all could sing before they could play, and I think that's significant. And a lot of people that really get good at playing the piano, they figured out for themselves before they even have any lessons to say, what they're doing in terms of music theory or anything. They just start playing. They figure out how to play in a certain key, and they figure, if there's this other key, here's what I would do. They just figure it all out. They play by ear. I think Count Basie, for example, never did learn to read music. He played everything by ear.
Wow.
Irving Berlin didn't. He just plucked it out with one finger.
Really?
That's right. He eventually learned to play, but interesting thing about Berlin is he learned to play on the black notes of the piano, so his favorite key was F sharp. Everybody else's worst key, right, was his favorite key. And he was so glued to the key of F sharp that he had what's called a piano with a sliding board. So if he wanted to play in the key of E flat, you just slide the whole string board so that E flat is now positioned under the F sharp key. And continue to play in F sharp, but it came out in E flat.
Wow.
He wasn't a very versatile piano player.
He was. But, the interesting thing is that, with the different methods, going back to them, actually the Kodai method makes really good sight readers because, you get this sense of which note is which in that translation. But on the other hand, the Suzuki method, where you start learning by ear, and completely learn by ear and don't get introduced to notation till later, has been shown to have been issues later with people when they have to read, then it's really hard for them.
Yeah.
That's why I'm wondering about the hand gestures. It's not writing in a sense, but it's a visual representation of a sound.
And it helps.
I bet it's a huge help. I bet it's a really huge help. And then it makes the transition to reading music a lot easier.
Exactly.
I kind of related, unrelated, but sort of related. Maybe some of you've heard this too. I'm amazed at the number of really accomplished musicians I know who say they see shapes and they see different tones have colors to them. You know, they're having a synesthesia experience when they're playing music. It's not purely an oral or aural experience for them. There's a visual component too to it. It's usually very idiosyncratic to them, you know, but it's not just not for everybody. But the number of people that I've had conversations about this is enough to make me think it's significant.
I am not that way, but I have talked to several people who, for example, see colors with certain keys or with certain pitches. And that's amazing to me because I don't. Now, I certainly feel moods and emotions with certain, you know, tone combinations that make chords, but that's a totally different thing from what you're describing. But yeah, I don't understand at all or experience what you just described, Ken, but I have definitely talked to some very good musicians who have that exact same experience. And I'm quite sure that's not anything that can be learned.
yeah, but it does show that there is possibly a visual processing element to music, even if it's idiosyncratic. You know, everybody has their own way of doing it.
But so that psychologically, it makes sense because the more connections you have to anything, the deeper it gets. You know. So if you just think of the melody note, I have to play a C, then that's a very abstract concept. But when you know the C and you kind of, your finger muscle feels where the C is and you have some association, oh, this is the hand signal that goes with it. You know, each one of those associations makes it a deeper experience, and that's why you see that.
Yeah, there's a picture on the Kodai Method website with kids holding fingers up. Do you, like, hold up one finger, two fingers? Is that how it works? It's a little unclear. But every singer's got their hands up in a gesture while they're singing.
Well, those signify the scale, the notes that they're on.
Scale tone, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if the altos are on scale tone 3, then there's a hand signal for scale tone 3, so they're holding up that particular signal. Mm-hmm. If the pranos are on a different note, so their hand may be in a different position.
Yeah. So jazz education, when people are trained in jazz, that starts, I guess, for people that start early would be high school. Yeah, sure, there are certainly high school jazz bands.
Middle school, actually, already.
Oh, really? Already? No kidding.
Yeah. In the States, they usually have the middle school bands in 7th and 8th grade.
And so that's 11 and – that's 12 and 13.
Mm-hmm.
And is the normal path you sign up for an instrument and then I guess you get lessons somewhere and then you show up to band and the band teacher leads you through the tunes?
Right. So what I saw with my kids here, obviously I grew up in the European system, but I had my kids here. So I saw them go through. So, it's actually even by sixth grade, you can join some things, some outside things. And in seventh grade, you can pick an instrument and there's one hour a day where you're in band. And you learn with the group, and taking lessons is up to you. Some just kind of learn along by whatever they have to do.
Okay.
But you can go through all the way to 12th grade and just play in the different ensembles. And, yeah.
So it starts when then? And did you say
seventh grade for sure.
Seventh grade.
At least here in the system, yeah.
Okay. And whatever instruments are available, that's what you end up playing.
Yeah, well, and, you know, me being an advocate for women in jazz, I mean, that's one of the issues that we still have to work on, because that's where a lot of the great divide starts.
the girls don't get the saxophones and trumpets.
Right, they get the flutes and the violins and
the clarinets and
then they don't end up in jazz band.
how is that? So that's the American system. So you experienced the European system. How do they handle music and education?
Well, in Europe, you mostly, or at least in Germany where I grew up, you mostly learn in community bands. So yes, you do have music in school, but it's kind of general music. You know, you learn about history and maybe there's a choir that you can join. But the instrument learning mostly goes on in community bands and community schools, which is highly encouraged and very well viewed. You know, learning an instrument is kind of the thing to do, but it's outside of school.
Oh, and so when you say community, so who would organize that and make it happen?
Community bands, most of them are subsidized by government funds, local funds, and it's usually a hired director who has a full-time job as a director of the band and or the community music school, and yeah.
So a town would have a music director, and he or she would have a bunch of different community-based music projects for people of different ages.
And a music school. That's
Wow, it sounds ideal.
Well, then look in Sweden. There's where it's ideal. There's every kid gets free music lessons.
Really? In Sweden?
Yeah, in Sweden. That's why you see all these Max Martins and great Swedish musicians killing it.
Okay.
I started to say that harkens to, you know, what happens in barbershop music. It's all just amateur musicians coming together. But they can make incredibly great music. But, you know, it's like the people who walk in the door kind of get hooked on barbershop. They may not be able to read music at all, but they have to have a good enough ear that they can sing a melody or they can sing a harmony and be in tune and just learn it by rote. But, you know, it's just, there's no, we don't sit out, and I sing in a chorus of 130 men, and there's no music lessons given. It's all just get up there, learn your part, and now let's start doing what you have to do to make the music take shape and come alive and have dynamics and all this sort of thing. But it's all just, it's very organic. Nobody, no, there's no lessons, no anything. Everybody just learns what to do by doing it.
And everyone's singing. They're not dealing with the techniques of an instrument.
Right. That's right. Mm. But, it may be the same principle. Learning about Louis Armstrong convinced me, you know, what was it he always said, Vic? He always said singing is playing. Somebody asked him, what's the difference between singing and playing? And he says, playing is singing. So, I mean, it may be the same thing.
That's such a huge, profound revelation. and sort of lost. I think nothing's more fundamental, and we're certainly getting it from a good source. It's not like he's a fringe character. I mean, if anybody knows, he knows. He knew.
Yeah. Right.
And I'm wondering just how.
The point is, he had the music in his brain, in his mind. And therefore, for him, it didn't much matter whether he sang it or played it. That's why, you know, when he became a cornet player, but pretty soon he would just stand up and kind of do scat, the same notes he would be doing if he was playing his horn. It just was all the same to him.
Yeah, I got that from Vic's.
Yeah, I mean, his.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, there is this quote that singing was more, he said, singing was more into his blood than the trumpet. Because, of course, you know, that was how he'd started out. I've recently been told that there is another interview where he was specifically asked how there was a young player asked him how to get into improvising. He said, "You've got to sing in a quartet. Listen to the melody and then learn your own lines, basically." I haven't actually got hold of a copy of this interview yet, but Ricky Riccardi at the Louis Armstrong House Museum has uncovered it. He showed me a typescript of it, but I haven't actually heard. But you know, it's quite clear from all of the things that you know Armstrong said that this is exactly how he did it. You know, he just converted his singing directly directly onto an instrument.
In that session that you and David did in New Orleans, one of you was quoting that something's to the effect that get any four black boys together and they're a quartet. It was that the knowledge
James Weldon one comes from. Yeah.
Yeah. So the knowledge of how to do this, or the culture that encouraged people to learn how to do it, was everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, you're in an age before radio and television and all the rest of it, and folks get together and just sing. You know, it's what they do. It's very, very clear from once you start looking at these oral histories and that this was just going on absolutely everywhere. Everybody was doing it.
I was reading a book by, I'm trying to get his name, Elijah Wald. He's phenomenal. Yeah, but Rick and I, we've written back and forth about him. And it's just interesting. There was a section in his book, How the Beatles Destroyed Rock and Roll, which is a very wide-ranging book. It's really not just about the Beatles and it's not just about rock and roll. But he talks about Philip Sousa, who was a huge proponent of music, of everybody learning how to play music, and he was really disturbed by the idea of recorded music. He thought it was a bad idea.
There's a famous letter, yeah.
So I guess was it Plato? One of those guys was concerned about the written language. He thought it was going to dull people's minds. That's a different topic, but. I mean, are we just because of the existence of recorded music? Are we doomed to have this sort of apartheid of some people learning to make music and the rest sitting on the sidelines? I guess that's one of my curiosities. You know, why is it this way? You know, you go to a place.
Well,
like,
you know, there's a lot of people who feel like. You know, music learning went way downhill with the advent of having, you know, just music in your home. You know, used to be, and a lot of my barbershop history research leads me to this, that, you know, back before the advent of radio, though everybody did something in the home. I mean, what do? You're sitting around at night and there's a piano in the parlor. What do? You make music. People went to the barber shop, and there was a guitar or something hanging on the wall. They made music while they were waiting. All of a sudden, you're in the 20s and 30s, you turn on the radio. And also, you didn't go to the live vaudeville show anymore, or at least if you did, it wasn't to see that live show. It was to watch this movie, which was a huge production of sound and color and had recorded music. So we became a nation of musical spectators as opposed to a nation of musical participants. And really, most people view that was kind of the demise of the historical barbershop quartet. Now, of course, we have a society to preserve the barbershop quartet, but that's an organization that came as it was dying. And the reason it was dying was because nobody was out in the street corner doing it anymore. They were at home listening to the radio.
Well, that raises an interesting point. There was a kind of revival of street singing doo-wop, right?
Yeah, in the 50s.
Yeah. I wonder how that happened. You know, I don't know. I don't know the answer, but it's just interesting.
Yeah, of course, vocal harmony never really died. You know, it's like, it's, okay, so after the historical barbershop quartet, there were all kinds of vocal groups. You know, the Mills Brothers kept music, vocal music, you know, disharmony alive for so many years with, first of all, four guys and then three guys. But there were a lot of vocal groups, the Four Freshmen, you know, and then you know, the High Lows. These groups were particularly accomplished harmonizers, and so it's but you know, but they were professional groups, so it wasn't like people were standing around, you know, in the cornfield anymore and harmonizing. Yeah, that practice had gone by the wayside. They used to have a term called curbside harmony. They used to say curbside harmony. That means people were standing around the street singing.
Yeah, but one thing I would say, David, is that we perhaps tend to also underestimate the fact there was this continuation of the gospel quartet tradition. I mean, that did keep going right the way through into soul, into Motown, you know, the Four Tops, the you name it, yeah. That quartet tradition carries right the way through. So there are other aspects to this, I think.
And there was I'm trying to think of this group. There were two brothers, and they had, I know they had a huge influence on the Beatles. In fact, some people think the Beatles just lifted their music. And it's not the Isley Brothers.
Not the Righteous Brothers.
I can't believe I can't remember this. But anyway, even the Beatles in their early years were very big on harmonies.
Yeah.
And they were very
good at it. That's what distinguished their music. You know, they came out of an era of R&B, which basically borrowed blues harmony. And blues harmony is cool. I love it. But it doesn't have a lot of harmonic variety. You know, the blues uses three chords. At least a traditional blues does. And so if you're in the key of F, you need an F, a B flat, a C, and that's it. But what the Beatles started doing is, I mean, they incorporated all kinds of classical harmonies, circle of fifths. I mean, their songs are incredibly sophisticated harmonically, and that was what you did not hear in rock music before they came along.
And now, now we're going far afield, but how did they learn that stuff? I mean, I did a little research, and I did discover, this doesn't answer the harmony question, but I did discover that in Liverpool, when they were growing up, there was huge interest in rhythm and blues and New Orleans music, and there were guys that made an extra living, seamen who would, you know, going between New Orleans and Liverpool, they would bring, you know, boxes of records and sell them, and they were a very hot item. And then apparently there's a military base between Manchester and Liverpool that was a very popular social place for people to come to dance and hear music. And they also introduced rock and roll, or pre-rock and roll or proto-rock and roll, to that region, and that the Beatles were just sort of the tip of the pyramid, that there were hundreds of bands trying to play music like that. But I know they also talked a lot about, what's that tradition? In Britain, they have these shows, these almost like, I guess it's like vaudeville. And they experienced them, McCartney did. It went to shows like that were vaudeville type of performances.
Music hall, I think, is the
music
term
hall.
You're trying to...
There you go. There you go,
yeah.
Music hall.
Yeah.
So what's the state?
Yeah, I'm no expert at all on the Beatles, but I do know that they, one or more of them, probably more than one of them, really had a sophisticated understanding of harmony and just harmonic variety. And if you, what's the song? Because the world is round, it makes me high.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Acapella. Yeah. I mean, that's an incredible piece of work. It doesn't sound like any other rock song you've ever heard from that era.
Yeah, and that wasn't given to them by their producer. They had to have that in them, right? You can't just wing that because a producer thinks it's a good idea. It has to be in you.
No, they harmonized it.
It's the Everly Brothers.
Everly Brothers. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Bye Bye Love.
Right. And
Wake Up Little Susie. Yep.
I mean, fantastic harmonizers.
Yeah, they were.
Yep. So what's the state
amazing
of the...
what they did with two parts, you know? As a barbershopper, I think, well, you can't do much with two parts, but they did a lot with two parts.
Yep. Yep, and I heard that they were a huge inspiration on the Beatles.
Ah. Yeah, so, I could believe that.
So what's the state of the art now? So there is a barbershop quartet world still functioning and still thriving. Do we have any popular singers that use harmonies anymore? I mean,
it depends on what you mean by popular, but yeah, there are certainly great groups that have some popular appeal. Pentatonix is an example. I mean, that's a pretty good rock group, and their music, I mean, I wouldn't say they're at the top of the charts or anything, but they're an a cappella group, six parts. They're fantastic. You can go on YouTube and listen to just some fantastic things that they do. And it's got all kinds of intricate harmonies in it. And it's kind of based on, kind of the smooth jazz harmonies or the high lows sort of, except it has a little bit more of a rock flavor. Later Gene Perling started another group called Singers Unlimited, and they were sort of they're at the pedestal of a cappella lovers. They did recordings in the 70s. Pentatonix and other groups like that kind of take their cue from that harmony. And then we also have Take Six, African American sort of jazz gospel group. They're fantastic. They sing a cappella harmony. So yeah, there's an active a cappella a community, and there's a contemporary a cappella society. I don't know if you've about Deke Sharon, but he's had been on TVs with plus that show Sing Out or whatever it was, which is kind of like an a cappella contest.
Sing Off.
The Bob. Yeah, go ahead.
Every college has the a cappella tradition. We usually have a boy and a girl's a cappella group. Like we had Straight No Chaser come out that did very well on
There's
Atlantic.
Another group that's very popular.
So if you go to the Sing Off, there's a whole series. I'm sure it's available online by now. There was this huge competition, and it was all these collegiate a cappella groups. That's where Pentatonix came out too. But there's some really cool ones.
the kids are singing a cappella in the universities like crazy. I mean, in my university, Washington University in St. Louis, I think there's eight a cappella groups.
Oh, wow.
You know, they have different slabs. Some of them are all male, some female, some mixed. There's one that sings Jewish songs, rock songs, classical songs. I mean, and they do a lot of their own arrangements. They do mostly their own arrangements. So it's a pretty vibrant scene, and they have these competitions. I've been asked to judge them from time to time. They're amazing.
And they're called...
Well, the whole movie Pitch Perfect, Perfect 1, 2, 3 kind of recultivated a lot of that scene.
That's right. That's right. And by the way, Deke Sharon did all the musical arrangements on those movies. So he's sort of the a cappella guru. I should say a word about the barbershop community. Like, barbershop is a worldwide thing. It's various organizations. In the United States, the Barbershop Harmony Society used to be all male, but now it's mixed gender. That's very recent. But there's an all-female group called the Sweet Adelines, and both of these organizations have 20,000 members apiece. And then there's worldwide movements. There's movements in Germany, in Sweden, in England, in Australia, New Zealand, Japan. So barbershop harmony really exists everywhere, and it's pretty close knit. And we all share arrangements, and everybody knows what the other is doing. We like to listen to each other's singing, recording. There are these big conventions that happen in the United States. I'm going to be going to one next week, which is in New Orleans. It'll probably have 6,000 or 7,000 participants.
Wow.
So it's pretty active.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, I've been a jazz fan since I was a young teenager, and I just didn't, until Vic's book, I really didn't understand there was a connection between the two musics.
It's amazing, Ken, because I've been singing barbershop for years and I've been loving traditional jazz for years, but I didn't realize there was that connection until I read Vic's book. You know, but and as I said, you may have heard me say in the lecture that we gave in New Orleans recently at the Satchmo Fest, I've sat and listened to traditional jazz time after time, and I would, you know, I listen to the instruments. I like to focus in on the clarinet. What's that person doing? And, you know, I think, man, that's exactly what a barbershop tenor does, or the trombone will do something. I said, that's exactly what a barbershop baritone does. And it just never struck me that there was a causal relationship here. And when I read Vic's second book, it was like an epiphany. I thought, oh, my God, why didn't I see this? It's the only thing that makes any sense. It's the only thing that makes sense. All these singers, all these players sang harmony before they sang. And when they picked up their horn, they were just doing essentially the same thing.
I hear it everywhere too now. Yeah, I mean, there's even a lot of old recordings where they're actually singing barbershop harmony, like vocally. Yeah. How I could have missed that all those years, I don't know.
Right. Yeah. If you listen to the Hot Five, it was a Hot Five or Hot Seven, Vic that does Basin Street Blues, and there's just a whole chorus of basically barbershop harmony, like they're harmonizing exactly like a quartet.
Hmm. So I guess we're in the very early days of this understanding, it'll take a while to percolate out. I'm wondering, maybe because it's been an hour and I'm sure everybody's got things to do today. Can you think of anything we can do to, you know, other than promote Vic's book, which I do at every occasion, to get this better, you know, this, get more people thinking and talking about the role of singing as a preparation for any kind of music, but specifically for jazz?
Well, certainly from my perspective, of course, I'm very pleased that folks are promoting my book, but I think the really useful thing is beginning this discussion between folks who are active in barbershop and folks who are active in jazz education to start to find ways that we can work together, because it's quite obviously some, you know, if this was foundational to how the first generation learned to do it, we should be able to reproduce that in some form. And working together between jazz and barbershop, I think, has got to be the way forward.
I don't know if there's a way to connect, for example, Barbershop Harmony Society with any jazz organizations to promote joint events or joint educational efforts, or I mean, just the mingling of the two would be helpful. Now, it happened a little bit at the Satchmo Fest when we gave our lecture, Vic, and then you gave the lecture a year ago. This year, we actually involved a barbershop quartet, a really good one, to come in and demonstrate, and then they gave a concert, a one-hour concert at the Satchmo Fest. The people seemed to love it, the organizers loved it, and so maybe that synergy can be developed from there. But I'd be happy to do what I can do. I mean, I have a little bit of influence, perhaps, in Barbershop Harmony Society, because I've taught in their schools and their educational things for many years, and I do a lot of arrangements. I'll be happy to try to facilitate any kind of joint efforts that anybody can think of that we could involve the two types of music together.
That's great. Go ahead.
So I was just going to say, I have raised some of these points in an article that I've written for the Jazz Education Network's new journal, which maybe Monica.
Did I accept it? I hope so.
Yeah, I believe it's been accepted. But, you know, the fact that that's the jazz folk are beginning to, you know, consider this as well, you know, from the other side. That was really my point.
Yeah, that show that you guys did together at Satchmo Fest, it was great. That was really fantastic. You know, to have the recorded examples and then the group sing. Maybe that's the way forward. Just more presentations like that. Might be interesting to include instrumental musicians. To play arrangements that show that the arrangements really are based on the same harmonic ideas as a barbershop.
Might be. Maybe, that'd be a cool thing to do.
Maybe that's next year at Satchmo Fest.
Maybe we can do that.
But that was
get us a good band to be a demo.
Yeah, I'm sure there'd be some especially some of the trad groups would probably be interested in participating in that. And then I think that the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow would be Wynton Marsalis, and because he's such an advocate of New Orleans and of Louis Armstrong in particular, and someday maybe that's a long term goal, because they put on programs all the time, and they're of course very high profile and very influential. They have that annual competition of high school jazz orchestras, and they're in contact with lots and lots of music teachers. Maybe that could be a long term goal to somehow catch their attention. Well, great. Well, thanks for joining us and doing this call and getting us to talk more about this. Monica, are you a music educator? Sorry, I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I'm a jazz pianist, and I teach at Indiana University. I teach in the arts management program right now, but all my degrees are in music education.
Ah. I mean, maybe someday someone could design a semester course, that puts all this together, the solfège and Vic's books and how make it an event, an academic event with a practical component too. People actually
right,
working
that
through.
Might be possible.
Yeah, yeah. Well, great. Well, I love this. It's one of the most, Vic. I love your book as much today as I did when I first read it. I think it's epically important, and we'll just keep chipping away at it. I have about 30,000 email subscribers, and I did mail the Satchmo Fest show that you guys did to them. So a couple of thousand people at least have seen it this week. And
I suspect you may get, Ken, some emails about our discussion about teaching how music is taught in elementary schools. I bet you have some teachers out there that say that, I do exactly what you say, or have some comment on that. If there are educators out there listening, I bet you get some response.
That leads to this question. I think this went very well, and we all sounded pretty intelligent. Would you mind me packaging this and mailing it out? Specifically, I would say, hey, if you're a music educator, please listen to this and give us feedback. Is that okay with everybody?
That'd be great. That's fine with me.
Absolutely.
Monica?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Good. I'm going to do that. And then I'll tell you what, hopefully we'll get some feedback, because I find, unless you specifically ask for feedback, you may not get any really. So I'm going to specifically mail this, specifically focused on music educators and specifically asking for them to participate and give their ideas.
Okay.
Great.
Sounds good to me.
Great.
Thanks,
well,
Ken.
Great. Nice to meet you, Monica and Dave, and great to talk with you again, Vic.
Good to talk with you, Ken. It's been a pleasure.
Yay. Everybody have a good day.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye, everyone.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos.